Ukraine. I don't know how you would define the war in Ukraine as being worse or better, but Russia is winning the battle on the ground against the Ukrainian armed forces, hands down. It is a rout. And as a result of that, we're seeing crisis management in the Western European countries, which have put all their stakes behind their puppet, Zelensky.
And on that note, I appreciate you both being with me. Very interesting discussion. Out of Berlin, Christoph Horstel, author and politician. Out of Belgrade, John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Appreciate you being with me. And as always, pleasure having you with us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21. Of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Young.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبرزوا لله جميعا فقال ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا
ما
سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Israel launches airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip amid heightened tensions following the regime's deadly raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Hezbollah strongly condemns Israel's latest massacre in the city of Nablus, saying only the resistance fighters' weapon can deter this enemy. And Moscow says the West is ready to plunge the entire world into the abyss of war to defeat Russia, adding that it's fighting the collective West in Ukraine. Our top story for this half hour, Palestinian mourners have held a massive funeral procession for the victims of the latest Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. At least 11 Palestinians, including a 14-year-old boy and a 66-year-old man, were killed in the attack. Over 100 others were injured, several of them critically. Palestinian officials have requested an emergency session of the UN Security Council on the Israeli massacre in Nablus. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says two of its commanders are among those killed. The Israeli regime has intensified crackdown on Nablus and the nearby city of Jenin since the inauguration of the regime's far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Thursday, a 30-year-old Palestinian youth identified as Muhammad Nabil Fawzi Abu Saba succumbed to injuries he suffered during a recent Israeli raid of a refugee camp in Jenin. More than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces across the West Bank so far this year. The Israeli military has carried out airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip a day after killing nearly a dozen Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Israeli warplanes fired missiles on Gaza City and the Al Buraij refugee camp located in the center of the coastal Palestinian territory. There were no immediate reports of casualties and damage from the airstrikes. The Israeli media earlier cited a military official as saying that the regime is preparing the attack in response to what he called 6 rockets fired from Gaza in the early morning. Anger is boiling among Palestinians at the latest Israeli bloodshed in the West Bank. Mona Candil is joining us now from Ramallah. First, Mona, welcome to the program. First of all, talk to us about the aftermath of Israel's raid that took place on Nablus City. A massive funeral procession was held for the victims of this raid. What updates do you have for us regarding the situation right now?
One day after a bloody massacre, let's say, in in Nablus City, we are speaking about 11 Palestinians had been killed in Nablus on Wednesday, including 3 elderly men over the age of 60, also Palestinian children, in addition to at least 2 Palestinian fighters who were identified as members of the jihad movement, according, of course, to Palestinians there in Nablus, and even to the Israeli military statements. Over 100 Palestinians had been wounded. Today, a general strike has been declared across the occupied West Bank, with no schools, no transportation as well, to express Palestinians' anger over the Israeli crimes that had been committed and continue to be committed by the Israeli forces against the Palestinians. The different Palestinian resistance groups have slammed the Israeli crimes and the killing of 11 Palestinians in Nablus and vowed that they would respond and that Palestinians will always be adherent to their choice of resistance, because in response to the these Israeli massacres and the Israeli aggression, Palestinians have nothing but to respond, and anything that would happen would be a natural response to the pain, to the crimes being committed by the Israeli forces.
And also, let's turn our attention to what took place earlier today. The Israeli raids and attacks on Gaza and the Al-Burej refugee camp, parallel to the escalation of violence that's taking place against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Is this along the lines of what many observers were stating, that the new far-right wing and extremist cabinet in Israel is in pursuit of a dangerous escalation?
Well, the Israelis claimed that they had bombed the Gaza Strip after Palestinian fighters launched several rockets from the besieged coastal enclave following the massacre that was carried out in the Gaza Strip. In the Nablus area, of course. What happens in the Gaza Strip, of course, would be angering and causing pain to the Palestinians, as well here in the occupied West Bank. And anything happens to Palestinians living in the West Bank would also cause severe pain and would promote Palestinian resistance group in the Gaza Strip to respond, at least. Here we can say that Palestinians are united in the face of the Israeli regime, in the face of this right-wing regime, and to respond to the crimes being committed, whether in the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank or anywhere here in the occupied territories. Of course, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip would not trigger the Israelis to carry out a widespread operation, let's say, or another war on the Gaza Strip. So there are calls for resistance groups here in the occupied West Bank to respond, not to remain silent, in order to face this crimes being committed by the Israelis here in the occupied West Bank. We have to say that since Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned back to office and more raids are being carried out, an escalation is clearly being seen here in the occupied territories with daily raids, daily arrests, confiscation of lands, demolition of homes, new plans for a new settlement units and expansion of the old settlements as well. So it seems that Netanyahu himself and his ministers are trying to send a clear message first to the Israelis and the settlers as well, that he would not allow Palestinians to have any form of a state in the future, that the Israelis have a right in this land, and that they would continue committing the crimes as an occupier. He keeps reminding Palestinians that they are living under occupation and that they must pay high price for living under occupation. However, according to the international laws and the human rights organizations, an occupier must not deal with those people being occupied in this way. Raids are not allowed, arrests are not allowed, but the Israelis keep dealing with the Palestinians as a state above the law, keeping reminding them that they are under occupation and that the Israelis will do whatever they want in order to, according what they try to tell the world, that they want to defend themselves and that they want to ensure that the Israelis live under security all the time, feel safe and secure, of course.
Thanks a lot, Mona Kandil, joining us from Ramallah. Moving on, Lebanon says, well, resistance movement has strongly condemned the latest Israeli massacre of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Hezbollah said the occupation forces' cruel targeting of innocent civilians confirms that this enemy can only be deterred by the weapon of the resistance fighters. Meanwhile, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya said the Israeli raid was part of the regime's systematic terrorism. Hisham Qasem, a senior Hamas official, also announced the brutal extrajudicial execution of Palestinians. He said the right response to Israel is the activation of resistance across the occupied territories and retaliatory attacks against the regime's forces and settlers. Iran's foreign ministry also called the raid a brutal terrorist attack. It urged the international community to take immediate action to stop the Israeli genocide of Palestinians. The UN Secretary General has called for an end to Israel's settlement construction activities in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Across the occupied West Bank and Gaza, hopelessness is spreading, feeding anger and despair. Each new settlement is another roadblock on the path to peace. All settlement activity is illegal under international law, and it must stop.
Antonio Guterres made the call in an address to the Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People. He said preventing further escalation across the occupied territories, reducing tensions, and restoring calm were immediate priorities. Addressing the same committee, Palestine's UN envoy said the occupied territories are, quote, on the verge of massive eruption. Riyad Mansour urged the UN to take action regarding Israel's settlement activities, noting that the world body is losing credibility. Israel's new extremist cabinet, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has defied international outcry over the regime's settlement activities. It has promised to continue building more settler units on Palestinian territories. The Czech Prime Minister says his country has supplied hundreds of pieces of heavy military equipment, including 89 tanks, to Ukraine over the past year. Petr Fiala said $1.8 billion worth of military hardware has been delivered to Kiev. They include fighting and armored infantry vehicles, multiple rocket launchers, air defense systems, and various types of munitions. He added that his country will continue supporting Ukraine as long as necessary. Meanwhile, Berlin says hundreds of instructors from Germany, Netherlands, and Norway will teach Ukrainian soldiers how to use Western tanks and other arms. The European Union has set up a special command to train up to 30,000 Ukrainian troops to help Kiev in its war with Moscow. Russia's UN ambassador says The West is ready not only to sacrifice Ukraine, but also to plunge the entire world into the abyss of war to defeat Russia. Vasily Nebenzia added that it's the collective West that is waging war in Ukraine, not Ukraine itself.
I think that today, 1 year after the active stage of the Ukrainian crisis began, very few doubt that it's not Ukraine that is fighting Russia, because Ukraine basically spent all of its military potential in the first weeks of the special military operation. But rather, it is a collective West in the presence of the United States, NATO's and European Union allies.
He said the U.S. and its European allies are ignoring, quote, neo-Nazism in Ukraine to maintain their global power. He also touched on the recent sanctions imposed on Moscow, saying they are actually hitting the developing world hardest. Nebenzia was addressing the opening of a U.N. General Assembly debate on a new resolution against Russia. The resolution, backed by Ukraine and its allies, is expected to call on Moscow to immediately and unconditionally pull its troops out of Ukraine. It will also urge a lasting and just peace agreement to the year-long war. Russian President Vladimir Putin has delivered a State of the Nation speech in the Russian capital Moscow, accusing Western countries of fanning the flames of a year-long war in Ukraine. This report, we take a look at the highlights from his address to members of both House of Parliament, military commanders, and soldiers.
In a State of the Nation address in Moscow on Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin has defended Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. Putin accused the U.S.-led NATO alliance of fanning the flames of the conflict in the mistaken belief that it could defeat Moscow in a global confrontation. He blamed the West for starting the conflict in Ukraine, saying Western countries led by the United States were seeking unlimited power in world affairs. The Russian president said Moscow was not fighting the people of Ukraine, stressing that Ukraine has become a hostage of the Kyiv regime and its Western masters, which have effectively occupied the country. He also accused the U.S.-led NATO of using the conflict as a pretext to supply Kyiv with arms and munitions. Putin warned that the more long-range weapons are sent to Ukraine, the longer Russia will push threats away from its borders. In an important announcement, Putin said Russia was suspending participation in a major arms control agreement with the U.S.
I have to say that Russia suspends its participation in the New START treaty. Let me repeat, Russia does not abandon the treaty, but suspends its participation in it.
The New START treaty was signed in Prague in 2010. It came into force the following year and was extended in 2021 for five more years after United States President Joe Biden took office. It caps the number of strategic nuclear warheads that the U.S. and Russia can deploy and deployment of land and submarine-based missiles and bombers to deliver them. Together, Russia and the U.S. hold about 90% of the world's nuclear warheads. Putin also hailed the resistance of the Russian economy in the face of massive sanctions by the West.
As I already mentioned, the West is launching not just a military and informational war against us, but has also opened an economic front. But it is achieving nothing nowhere and will not achieve anything.
He added that the Russian economy has managed to do well despite Western countries' predictions of its collapse.
A man suspected of killing a woman on Wednesday in the U.S. state of Florida returns to the scene of the crime hours later and guns down a television reporter and a 9-year-old girl. Police said the suspect, identified as 19-year-old Keith Melvin Moses, was arrested shortly after the second shooting. They still have no explanation for why the man went on a shooting rampages, but according to the police, Moses was believed to be an acquaintance of the first victim.
The shooting this morning, the two shootings of the two news reporters, and the shooting of the mother and the 9-year-old child are all connected. The same suspect, Mr. Moses, is responsible for all those shootings. He's been charged, formally charged, in the murder this morning, and we expect charges soon on all of the other victims.
Moses faces charges in the attack of two news reporters, as well as for the fatal shooting of the 9-year-old girl and wounding her mother inside their nearby home. He was already been charged with killing the woman in her 20s who was shot in a vehicle hours earlier. That's a wrap for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
in the limelight.
Wind turbines and solar panels are now generating almost enough electricity to power every home in China. The National Energy Administration said at a briefing recently, wind and solar output jumped 21% last year to 1,190 terawatt hours of electricity. That's not far off total residential power consumption of 1,340 terawatt hours, the NEA said, which was a 14% increase on the prior year as more people spent time at home. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Renew Economy reported, China's National Energy Administration has reported that the country installed a combined 125 gigawatt of new wind and solar capacity in 2022, bringing its total cumulative renewable energy capacity to over 1,200. Out of the new renewable energy capacity added was 37.6 GW of new wind energy capacity and a whopping 87.4 GW of newly installed solar power. According to Wang Dapeng, an official with the National Energy Administration, NEA, speaking during a news briefing held in Beijing recently, while the impact of new generating capacity installed during 2022 will only really be felt when looking at 2023's numbers, the NEA also reported that renewable energy account for 47.3% of China's total power generation capacity at the end of 2022, up 2.5% compared to 2021. Interestingly, as highlighted by Bloomberg News, China's wind and solar is now generating almost enough electricity to power every home in China, with renewable generation surpassing 1,190 TWh in 2022 and residential power consumption hitting 1,350 TWh, the near match is a big milestone for China. This does not include industrial power consumption, and only 17% of electricity use was classified as residential in 2020, according to the International Energy Agency, IEA. Though this will have increased during the 2 years of chaotic COVID-19 pandemic, China's industry nevertheless remains king. Also, RT had an eye on this issue, writing, China's wind and solar power generation surged last year and is now almost equal to household demand for electricity, the National Energy Administration, NEA, announced recently. However, the share of residential intake is only a fraction of overall consumption, meaning that the Asian country is still heavily reliant on fossil fuels. In 2022, wind and solar energy production soared 21% to 1,190 terawatt hours TWh of electricity, according to NEA. Despite the surge in Chinese wind and solar power installations and generation, only 17% of electricity use in the country was classified as residential in 2020, while industry accounts for around 60% of all electricity demand, according to International Energy Agency. Beijing is ramping up the rollout of solar and wind capacity in line with its ambitious plans to produce 33% of its electricity from renewable resources by 2025 in order to reduce carbon emissions. At least 30 Chinese provinces have unveiled more renewable installation programs. In December, China launched a massive clean energy project worth more than $11 billion in its seventh largest desert in the province of Inner Mongolia. The solar and wind power base, with an overall installed capacity of 16 million kW, will be the world's largest renewable electricity generation facility of its kind in a desert area, according to the company in charge of its construction. However, some economists warn that this year the Chinese economy will expand much faster after lifting COVID restrictions, meaning that even with increased wind and solar capacity, the country will still need more fossil fuel-powered energy generation to keep its economy growing. Meanwhile, Global Times noted, construction of diverse renewable energy projects are accelerating across China with large centrally administered state-owned enterprises. Major players in the rapidly growing sector stepping up activity after the Spring Festival holidays. China Huoneng Group, the country's biggest coal power generator, announced in a recent meeting that it will pivot to operating renewable energy projects with a total capacity of more than 30 million kilowatts in 2023. Its investment is likely to reach 100 billion yuan, that is $14.66 billion. A total of 152 new energy projects involving 29 provinces and regions are underway or at preparatory stage. The projects cover clean energy bases in the country's north, offshore wind farm in the east, and integrated bases of hydro power and wind farm in the southwest, plus scattered projects in the central and eastern regions. Bidding to build offshore wind farms has become active. Since the beginning of February, relevant agencies have announced winning bids for the procurement of wind turbines for a large new energy project in the port of Huzhou, South China, Huadong Province. Those deals have activated both the upstream and downstream segments of the renewable energy industrial chain, with prices of polysilicon, silicon wafers, cells, and other raw materials in the photovoltaic sector all increasing, and project's operational rate is ticking up amid expectations that demand will be gradually released after the Spring Festival holidays, according to an analysis by Essence International. China's large SOEs are committed to leading the country's new energy transition, and they are the largest investors in the sector. And their active bidding bodes well for project construction in 2023, said Fitch Ratings. Also, many local governments have set eyes on developing clean energy, deemed as a driving force for driving local economic growth, as the nation has vowed to achieve the dual carbon goals on time. Renewable energy development is a focus of many local governments' annual work reports. East China's Shandong province proposed a target of renewable energy installation capacity to reach 80 million kilowatts this year. North China's Inner Mongolia Autonomous Region, one of the country's largest coal producers, pledged to fast-track renewable energy projects. Chen Zheng, the deputy head of the region's energy department, said on February 7th, the region will grasp this historic opportunity brought by renewable energy development by speeding up construction of whole industrial chain in an attempt to build a new industrial Inner Mongolia. The region has made continuous progress during recent years in promoting green transition by giving priority to the construction of large solar and wind energy bases. By 2025, the installed capacity for renewable energy generation in the region will exceed coal-fired power, according to the action plan. During the next four decades, the proportion of wind power, photovoltaic, and other renewable energy generation in China is expected to exceed 65 to 70% as the country unswervingly pushes forward the green transition, said Lin Boqiang, director of the China Center for Energy Economics Research at Xiamen University. Lin said, since the installed capacity of renewable energy represented by wind power and photovoltaic projects will usher in explosive growth in the medium and long term, we should actively promote the construction of large new energy bases in the Northwest. China saw a steady growth in renewable energy capacity in 2022, data from the National Energy Administration showed. As of the end of last year, the installed capacity of renewable energy hit 1.21 billion kilowatts, accounting for 47.3% of the total installed power generation capacity, surpassing coal. In 2022, China generated 2.7 trillion kilowatts of electricity from renewable energy sources, which accounted for 31.6% of total electricity consumption, equivalent to the entire power consumption of the EU in 2021.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
The story of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia these days has made headlines in many parts of the world, from its domestic politics and relations with the U.S. to its ground and aerial attacks on Yemen. But one of these developments was very important and strange. Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was once the most trusted journalist of the royal family, went missing in a peculiar way. He entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, but never came out. After an hour, his fiancée, who was waiting outside, informed his colleagues at the Washington Post via social media. And after several days, Jamal Khashoggi grabbed the headlines across the world. The operation that was aimed at eliminating Khashoggi turned into the biggest scandal in Saudi history. But the point is that Saudi Arabia and Turkey have their stories connected to one another in a strange place, in Istanbul, or the ancient city of Constantinople, the capital city of the Ottoman Empire, which goes back to 100 years ago when the First World War ended, the Ottoman Empire collapsed, and Saudi Arabia was born. Geographical maps have not remained unchanged. Today's borderlines between nations and regions have seen constant changes over the centuries. Some people have come, put a pen on the map, and changed the lines as they wished and thought it was better, placing people on each side of the borderlines, and stories after stories have unfolded. In the autumn of 1914, the world's big powers were engaged in a bloody conflict for months because some did not like the borderline set on the map at that time and were seeking little changes to them. Groups of young people, some on board ships, trains, and cars, and some by bicycles and horses, and even on foot, were dispatched from across the world to the front lines that were supposed to change the future of geographical maps. A war that was supposed to be concluded in a short period of time was dragging on with no end in sight. This is Sarajevo, a city whose strange events at the beginning of the 20th century decided the world's fate several decades later. Sarajevo is located in Bosnia that was annexed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire several years before the war. But the neighboring Serbia was opposed to the move because it was seeking to expand the Balkan region through uniting Slavs, and from 1914 onwards was creating unrest and insecurity in different Bosnian cities. But now, it was time to give a stern warning to the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. The long-awaited day was June the 28th, 1914, when Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austro-Hungary, was in Sarajevo on an official visit. Ferdinand and his wife were leaving Sarajevo's municipality when they were assassinated by 19-year-old Bosnian nationalist Gavrilo Princip. The young man had been armed by the Serbs. On July the 23rd, the Austro-Hungarian government demanded an investigation into the assassination, which was rejected by Serbia. In less than 3 months, the assassination made that time's big European powers engage in a brutal and complicated conflict. The two warring sides, in order to maintain their former positions, built trenches running parallel to one another that were 700 kilometers long and stretched from Belgian coasts to the Swiss Alps. The war pitted Germany as well as the Ottoman Empire and Austro-Hungary against France, Britain, and Russia. Soldiers on both sides of the battlefield looked more like miners than military troops. This way, each side blocked the other. Belgians opened their dams to drown German troops digging in inside the trenches. Winter was approaching and the trenches were gradually becoming cravens of ice, where troops sheltering inside were about to die. All roads were closed. Troops on both sides of the front were floundering in blood, constantly firing at each other. The Allies believed that the battlefield should be changed somewhere behind the enemy front, where it could be stabbed in the back. One of these plans on the map was to gain access to Ottoman borders from behind. The Ottoman Empire had become a strong ally of Germany months after the start of the war and had turned into an effective force on the front line. Constantinople, which was previously called Byzantium and is now named Istanbul, was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire for more than 11 centuries and the capital of its successor, the Ottoman Empire, for over 4 centuries. In 1914 and prior to the First World War, Constantinople's population was around 1 million. They had different nationalities and languages, and most of them were Muslim, Greek, or Armenian. In those days, Europe's influence on the architecture of the newly constructed buildings and the clothing of people in Constantinople was quite clear. In those years, new political forces known as Young Turks were emerging in the Ottoman Empire. They formed a party called the Committee of Unity and Progress and turned the Ottoman king's position into a ceremonial one. The Ottoman borders had once extended to Crimea in the north, to Baghdad and Basra in the east, to the Persian Gulf coast in the south, to Egypt and North Africa in the west, and had stretched beyond Balkan nations in Europe and reached near Austria's Vienna. But the borders in the early 20th century were threatened by big powers from all sides. In 1914, the shrinking Ottoman Empire no longer ruled North Africa, Hungary, or much of southeastern Europe. The leaders of the Committee of Unity and Progress were sitting around the fire, feeling that hungry animals were prowling in the dark. The empire was shrinking more and more in the early 20th century. The leaders were trying to save the empire before it collapsed in the New World. Prior to World War I, they were making efforts to protect the remaining regions under Ottoman rule from further aggression through making an alliance with a big European power. Germany, under King Wilhelm II, had rejected the Ottoman demand for alliance. But after the war, it changed its mind on grounds that even the declining Ottoman Empire could have an impact on the fate of the conflict. Shortly after the start of the war in November of 1914, and after the Ottoman Empire officially joined the war, its caliph, in the middle of regular demonstrations in Constantinople, declared war on Britain. While Ottoman troops were preparing to fight the Allies, Saudi deserts were chosen as the venue to infiltrate the Ottoman borders. Assistants of British Secretary of War, Herbert Kitchener, informed him that a person proper to accept ruling Muslims had already made contact. That person was the ruler of Mecca, whose name was Hussein ibn Ali. Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, was conquered by the Al Saud in 1902 and has remained their ruling center since then. But in the early 20th century, Riyadh was only a small part of the vast areas of Najd and Hejaz, which was ruled by the Ottoman Empire. Saudi Arabia was barren desert, and Hejaz was its most deserted and least attractive province. This region had a population of 300,000 people, half of whom were Bedouins and the rest were townspeople. Although Hejaz was part of the Ottoman Empire, its distance from Constantinople gave it a sense of autonomy. The distance seemed even longer in the absence of developed means of transportation and communication. main product produced in Hejaz were dates that are said to have 100 varieties. However, the main source of income for people was the annual Hajj pilgrimage, which brought 70,000 pilgrims to Mecca every year. In 1908, Ottoman King Abdul Hamid II appointed Hussein ibn Ali as the Sharif of Mecca and ruler of Hejaz. The title of Sharif was given to an individual who was descended from Prophet Muhammad, and Sharif Hussein was from Hashim clan. After Sultan Abdul Hamid II was deposed by the Committee of Unity and Progress, a silent war gradually broke out between Sharif Hussein and the Young Turks as he was attempting to gain more independence in Hejaz. That was because full independence in ruling Hejaz and especially ruling Mecca as the spiritual center of the Islamic world would bring power which could tempt anybody to gain. Sharif Hussein was playing with both sides of the battle, the Ottomans and the British, to buy time and find a solution in future. At the same time, he was also consulting with his tough rival in eastern Saudi Arabia, Abdul Aziz bin Saud. Abdul Aziz was the leader of Al Saud and the Wahhabi sect. The place he had conquered in January of 1902 was a small village with mud walls whose latitude and longitude was hard to determine by cartographers in the West. Riyadh was exactly located in the middle of the desert. Night of January the 16th, 1902, Abdul Aziz and 40 of his companions, using the darkness of the night, passed through the palm groves around Riyadh and crossed the high walls of the village. At sunrise, Abdul Aziz's forces entered the house of Riyadh's ruler, and a fierce fighting broke out between them. Finally, the ruler of Riyadh was shot dead by Abdul Aziz's fighters. After gaining power in Riyadh and its surrounding areas, Abdul Aziz demanded support from Britain. But in those years, the scorching dry deserts of Saudi Arabia, especially where Abdul Aziz ruled, were of little value for Britain to engage in clashes with the Ottomans. But now, everything was different compared with the years prior to the war, and the game had changed. In the late summer of 1914, Sharif Hussein's son, Abdullah, on behalf of his father, visited British intelligence chief in Cairo, Gilbert Clayton, and told him that Saudi Arabia was a hotbed of an insurgency. At that time, Abdullah intended to attract the support of a foreign power for fear that Young Turks would topple his father. During those days, the topic of conversation in most Arab regions was the long-running debate on the identity of Arab-speaking people in the Ottoman Empire, a debate that emerged at cafes in Beirut and Damascus in the 19th century and spread to Paris neighborhoods where students lived. In fact, all the individuals attending these meetings in different Arab parts of the Ottoman Empire, from Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine to Iraq, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, felt threatened with the Committee of Union and Progress's tendency towards Turkism. Britain began investing in these people and meetings at the most sensitive period of time. In January 1915, British Secretary of War Herbert Kitchener, after getting approval from the Foreign Office and to attract Arab-speaking people, took even another step and ordered the British agency in Cairo to issue a declaration stating that Britain would not only help Saudi Arabians, but also all Arab speakers in Asia, from Palestine and Syria to Mesopotamia, gain independence.
In the limelight.
U.S. federal authorities have warned more than 100 children have been discovered to be illegally employed by a slaughterhouse cleaning firm across the U.S. The Department of Labor announced that a federal investigation found Wisconsin-based Packers Sanitation Services Incorporation, PSSI, employed at least 102 children ranging from 13 to 17 years old to work overnight shifts at 13 meat processing facilities in 8 years.